The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. He is on the road today with the Celtic Throne crew as they travel out for their next performance. I think he's hoping to bring you a show from on the road coming up tomorrow, so you can look forward to that. But for today, you are stuck with me, I'm afraid. Well, there's lots of news as usual. We've got, I'll just get into a couple of stories before we get into the main subject that I want to talk about today that follows on a little from what I talked about last time I was on the show. But just to cover a couple of important bits of news, you had the latest court case, the latest ruling from the Supreme Court in the United States yesterday, where the Supreme Court ruled... they struck down a Louisiana law that regulated abortion clinics. So these clinics, the rule just restricted, you know, made sure that abortion clinics met a certain minimum standard. I think they had to be within about 30 miles from a hospital. The staff working there had to be above a certain standard and to be certified, I think, to work at the hospital or have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. But the court struck it down. And once again, just like we've seen over the last few weeks, Chief Justice John Roberts was crucial for shutting that down. Judicial Watch wrote in that Chief Justice Roberts, in another political move, bends the rule of law to accommodate and protect the radical political position that the Constitution prevents the states from taking steps to protect innocent life. The Chief Justice has repeatedly broken his promise to be a neutral umpire and instead too often acts as a politician in robes. Justice Thomas, he wrote in his dissent that today a majority of the court perpetuates its ill-founded abortion jurisprudence by enjoying a perfectly legitimate state law and doing so without jurisdiction. That was Justice Thomas in his dissent. So what happened here was almost bizarre in terms of the contortions that Justice Roberts is tying himself into, where previously, that was just back in 2016, there was a similar case in Texas. The Supreme Court back then also shot that law down. But back then, Justice Roberts dissented. He believed that that law should not be shut down in 2016. Presented with the same case this time around, he basically relied on the stare decisis principle, that what has been decided in the past should stand. So it's wrong, but we decided that it was, but we went down that wrong path before, and so we should keep going at that. So just a bizarre ruling, but a ruling where it does seem like this court is just bending to whichever way the political wind blows. Well, another story I just wanted to mention, we're seeing more and more with these statues under attack. Sam showed me a story this morning from, I think it was the New York Times, where there was a writer there saying, yes, you know, we should tear George Washington down. Anybody who's ever owned a slave, their statue should be coming down. We're seeing that principle here in the UK. The latest statue to come under attack in the UK is the Emperor Constantine. Or Saint Constantine, as he is been made a saint by the Catholic Church. And York Minster is saying that they're looking at, or that statue is being looked at now, after those comments that you heard from Mr. Flurry played yesterday from the Archbishop of Canterbury. That statue is there. It's in the south piazza of the Minster. The Telegraph writes, York Minster has received complaints that the Emperor also supported slavery in Roman times. So a Roman Empire, the Romans had slavery. Now his statue has to come down. And in some ways, I'm kind of glad that while it's looking at Constantine's history, I think that is something that more people need to do. Though we do need more scrutiny of this guy. I mean, like I said, the Catholic Church made him a saint because he really brought Catholic religion to the heart of the Roman Empire and then ended up enforcing things like the Trinity and Sunday observance all across the Roman Empire and on all Christians in the empire. And yeah, I think it is a good for people to go back and say, well, who was this guy that was so fundamental to Western civilization? And what was he like? I think he's one of the few saints that I know of that killed his own wife and his firstborn son. And it's kind of, you're in this odd state now with the statue movement where, you know, Constantine boiled his wife alive. But we're not having a go at him for that. We don't really have a problem with that. But he was emperor of an empire that supported slavery. So that's why he's got to go. Like I said, it just starts to get very odd. You know, I'm curious to see who comes under attack, because if we're going after all of these slave traders, surely it seems to me, maybe as somebody who's a bit of a techie and who likes history, I'm in a rare bubble here asking this question, but how long is it until we go after Bluetooth? You know, this technology that maybe you're listening to this show using your wireless headphones right now is named after the Viking king Harald Bluetooth. And the Vikings were massive slave traders, way bigger scale than even the transatlantic slave trade. So, you know, are we going to go start going after Bluetooth headphones? But like I said last time we were talking about slavery, where this was such a common evil, absolutely an evil, but it is everywhere throughout history. It just about, the longer you go back, it just includes just about everybody. I mean, I guess that you've got the biblical society that is a free of slavery as the term kind of means today, but you've got for the most part, anyone ancient is going to have been involved in slavery at some time. But anyway, I'll leave that aside before I start going on that too much. I want to talk for most of the show today about a couple of things that are very much in the news. Very relevant to everyone, even if you don't live in Britain, wherever you live in, and that is Britain's National Health Service, the NHS, and the British Empire. And two things very much in the news. Nigel Lawson famously quipped that the NHS is the closest thing the English people have to a religion. And haven't we seen that over the last few weeks, whether you've been watching from abroad or whether you've been here? We've seen the clap for the NHS. You can't go to church on Sunday, but thou shalt come out on Thursday evenings at 8 o'clock and clap for the NHS. We saw Britain sacrifice its nursing homes to the NHS. We'll empty out the hospitals because they're part of the NHS, and we'll put the sick in care homes. They're not part of the NHS. We want to make sure that the Conservative Party can be seen as upholding and protecting the NHS. And that's because the NHS is something that the British people really, you know, love and support. By giving this show, I am completely destroying my chances to ever be the British Prime Minister. That would be a political impossibility now. Of course, it would be a political impossibility before. But if you're a British politician, you cannot say anything ever bad about the NHS. And if you do, you're committing political suicide. There was a latest piece of news where they're talking about having a new holiday for the National Health Service. So you celebrate Independence Day in the US on July 4th, your Canada Day July 1st. Well, we're looking at NHS Day in the UK on July 5th. I don't know if that's what they'd officially call it, but July 5th is when the NHS came into existence. The Telegraph had a story, business leaders called for epic applause for NHS. Maybe I wrote that. I don't know if that was their exact headline. But you had these leaders writing a letter saying they want an epic applause. The Telegraph wrote that it has been described as the biggest thank you the country has ever seen. They wrote, as well as applauding, participants will be encouraged to come together for a drink of a cup of tea with family, friends, and neighbours to reflect on the bonds that have been sustained in recent months while observing the latest social distancing guidelines. And if this is about the only thing that you can be positive about in Britain, that you're allowed to be enthusiastic about, that you're allowed to be patriotic about, If you say, you know, the British blank is the best in the world, whatever you fill that blank with, I think you'd be denounced as being racist and jingoistic and xenophobic. If you said that statement, unless you said the British NHS is the best in the world, well, then yes, we'll get behind that. I mean, Sam was saying earlier, it's kind of rare to see Britons be proud about anything or any of their achievements or boast about anything. But the NHS, oh, we will boast about that forever and a day. And it's not new. It's not just something that's come about from the coronavirus. You might remember the opening ceremony 8 years ago at the London Olympics, where the NHS featured very prominently in this opening ceremony. Here's a quick clip of that.
After World War II, on an Alan Berens famous principle, no society can legitimately call itself civilized if a sick person is denied medical aid because of lack of means.
Just a fairly quick clip. I didn't want to spend too long. It was about a 10-minute feature on the NHS. And I mean, if you're watching the audio stream, there's not a huge amount. Or if you're just listening to the audio, there's not a huge amount going on there. But we've got this, we'll celebrate. And it was a bit bizarre watching that 8 years ago where we're talking, the whole thing was built around the biggest milestones in Britain's history. And the NHS was up there for a lot of people as being one of those big, massive milestones in British history. Now, I said at the same time, and we even talked about at the start, you know, the British Empire is also all over the news, but it's something to demonize, something to condemn, something that most people in Britain are ashamed of. So how did we get here? How did we get to this state of affairs? Well, I want to go back over a critical period of history where the nation faced two choices, where really Britain gave up its NHS, gave up its national health system, gave up its empire for the NHS and for the welfare state. This was how the British Empire fell. It was, in a lot of ways, a deliberate choice. And it was a change of focus. We're going to focus inwards. We're going to focus on healthcare, and we're going to focus on welfare. And I think most modern politicians, maybe even the majority of people in Britain, think that that's the right decision. But there's a critical lesson for us to learn in this, that we can take home from, and even a practical lesson that we can apply from Britain's history. It's something that contains a message for any power in the world that says something about, well, how to be great and how to decline. Because Britain emerged from World War II as one of the victors, one of the empires. I mean, one of the winners. With a massive empire having helped defeat Germany and Japan. And so quickly, that was gone. How did that happen? A lot of people portray that as inevitable, that World War II exhausted the empire, that it was doomed to decay. But I think if you look at some of the facts, you know, yes, there was a substantial amount of decay that had set in, but a lot of that was a decay in people's minds and attitudes rather than in, well, I guess that does tie into actual power, but rather than in actual fact. And there's some significant elements of that decline were a choice. Now, Britain didn't have the same industrial capacity as the United States at that point. It didn't have the same capacity to sustain large military spending as the United States. So I don't think it could have kind of kept going as the world's number one empire, at least not in the longer run. But still, things could have gone very differently. And there were some catastrophic events that happened because of that decision to turn around from empire. A massive death toll because of that decision. I was reading a quote. This is from Paul Johnson's book, Modern Times, His History of the 20th Century. And he talks about this time period, the end of World War II, where Britain's making this choice. And he says, well, he says, the defeated nations, France, Germany, and Japan, were driven by necessity to a fundamental reappraisal. But Britain had not been defeated. She had stood alone and emerged victorious. Could she not carry on as before? Churchill had fought desperately for British interests. He rejected utterly Roosevelt's notion of America and Russia as the two idealist powers and Britain as the greedy old imperialist. A bit further down, he was somberly aware that Russia was anxious to tear the British Empire to pieces and feast on its members, and that America, too, aided by the Dominions, and especially Australia and New Zealand, favoured decolonization. But anyway, that was the situation. And then a bit further on, well, Paul Johnson, he wrote that British policy after World War II, he says it was confusion and irresolution. So Churchill was gone from the picture. Well, he writes, 6 months later, Churchill had been thrown out by the electorate. His Labour successors planned to disarm, decolonize, and make friends with Russia and build a welfare state. This is what Britain chose after World War II. It looked like you could have this empire that, or this power that was going to go on for strength. You're normally the winners of a war, even if they've sacrificed a lot in that war, tend to dominate the peace as well. But you saw a very different turnaround. You saw a turnaround there with Britain. He writes, there was a failure of vision, a collapse of will. In the late summer of 1945, the British Empire and Commonwealth seemed to have returned to the meridian of 1919. British power was stretched over nearly a third of the globe. No nation had ever carried such wide-range responsibilities. 25 years later, everything had gone. History has never before witnessed a transformation of such extent and rapidity. So what happened in this transformation? He says that, he writes, nor was there any physical evidence for a collapse of loyalty towards the British Empire among its subject people. So why did this greatest empire the world had ever seen, just even looking in terms of territory conquered, why did it fall so fast? Well, you had a couple of things happen that had been building up to before this time, but happened right in 1945. The population as a whole decided it had no interest in empire, and that they began massive spending on welfare programs. And you saw this very quickly after World War II. Andrew Roberts also talks about this period in his book, A History of the English-Speaking People Since 1990. And he writes, when Attlee became Prime Minister in July 1945, between VE Day and VJ Day, the greatest long-term threat to his country was that she would squander the opportunity she had won and therefore hamstring future generations of Britons. Over a quarter of her national wealth had been lost in the previous 6 years of war, so the vast sums of martial aid that were being directed from America desperately needed to be spent rebuilding her industrial and transport infrastructure and making her economy competitive again. Instead of doing that, Attlee effectively wasted it on trying to build the utopian society which socialists in those heady days called the New Jerusalem. And he goes on to talk about how Germany took this martial aid and invested it on rebuilding infrastructure, modernizing its industry. By 1950, Britain was investing 9% of its economy on industry and infrastructure. In Germany, it was 19%, more than double. Because Britain instead was spending much more money on trying to create a socialist welfare state and set up programs like the National Health Service. And you can see how some of this history is very applicable to the political debates going on at the moment. And it took a few years to get things up and running. But everywhere you look then, you saw this massive jump in social spending. Between 1948 and 1951, for example, healthcare spending went from $6 billion to $11 billion. And this is something that has just kept going up and up and up, even as a percentage of Britain's economy. Healthcare spending just shoots up. I mean, even as recently as the Labour government that came in power in 1997, healthcare spending rocketed up while they were there. It wasn't just government spending. There was also this big focus to make sure everybody had a job. And this became the priority. And you can understand that. Wanting to make sure everyone has work. But to do this, the government nationalized a whole lot of industry, made it government run. And so businesses stopped being competitive. They were run by the government not to, you know, make a profit and therefore produce efficiently. They were run to keep people in employment, which often means doing things very inefficiently, having very expensive ways to produce things. And so British productivity fell drastically. While in the meantime, you had Germany building up these brand new factories. And in the long, you know, this nationalization, it sounds great and compassionate and making sure everybody has a job. But in the long run, it destroyed the British manufacturing sector. I mean, Mr. Flores talked, he had a whole show, I remember, a few years ago, where just down the road from us, we've got the Coventry Motor Museum. And he made the point that it's, you know, a relatively niche museum just on car manufacturing in this part of the world. And you see the United States and Britain in prophecy in this car manufacturing museum, where Britain became this world leader in motor manufacture, and then it just all goes. And I don't think we have any significant car companies. I think maybe Morgan, I think, might be the only British-owned car company left. All these other ones like Jaguar, Mini, Bentley, Rolls-Royce, they're owned by other countries now. And Morgan is not exactly a huge car company. But the point is, there was this effort to, well, we're going to keep people in jobs. And this focus on employment over productivity, and it destroyed the car industry and a whole load of other industries, pretty much the entire manufacturing sector. And this is how the whole country behaved and focused. It wasn't just a government decision. You know, we can talk about the Labour government that came in there, and they did a lot of things wrong, but at the same time, you know, they were voted in, and there really was a mass support for this kind of strategy. And you had the unions pushing for the same kind of thing. 14 days after Germany surrendered in May 1945, for example, 14 days, Berlin had its buses up and running. 2 weeks after surrendering. In London, the victor, the bus drivers were on strike and the buses weren't going. So you've got this national focus inwards. And at the same time, this new Labour government, Attlee's government, it made a very public move away from empire. And they very abruptly dropped India. Just gave up on it. And we'll look at, you know, the consequences of that in just a minute. But nobody in England really cared about preserving the empire and India anymore. And so, you know, throughout this whole period, you had the rise of political, you know, well, professional left-wing agitators, especially in India, but also so elsewhere. J.C. Davison, he's writing at the time, the fact is that the British government, the Viceroy, and to a certain extent the states, have been bounced by Gandhi into believing that a few half-baked, semi-educated urban agitators represent the views of 365 million hard-working and comparatively contented cultivators. It seems to me that the elephant has been stamped by the flea. So you had the rise of professional agitators in India, left-wing politicians pushing for independence, and no one in Britain really cared much about what happened to India. And so they were very, very happy to let it go. Paul Johnson, he quotes that quote I just read, but then he goes on to write, India illustrates the process whereby the full-time professional politician inherited the earth in the 20th century. Reforms created an alien system of representation. A class of men, mainly lawyers, organized themselves to manipulate it. In due course, the governing powers handed over to them. The dialogue was entirely between the old and the new elites. The ordinary people did not come into play except as a gigantic walk-on crowd in the background. The process was to be repeated all over Asia and Africa. The forms of the Westminster, Paris, or Washington model were preserved. And he goes on to write, Lenin's Bolsheviks of 1912, Mao's CCP, or Chinese Communist Party cadres of 1949, and the Congressmen of India came to power by different routes. But they had this in common. All three new ruling groups were men who had engaged in any other occupation except politics, and had devoted their lives to the exploitation of a flexible concept called democracy. It's an interesting quote to think about again in this current day and age. Michael Flynn had an article, I think it was yesterday, where he talked about how there's a 2% that's in danger of dominating the 98%. that you can quite easily get a few agitators creating this impression of a mass movement and succeeding. And that's what we saw happen with country after country, where Britain handed over empire, not to the people, but to a new elite. But in Britain, as I said, there was no interest in keeping the empire. It wasn't even giving up India wasn't even controversial. The British Parliament voted on it without division, which means there were so few people opposed to giving this up that it wasn't even worth calling an official vote. It was just allowed to be let through. Britain had no interest now in empire and in India. It was just all about social spending. And again, if you think that's a good thing, just bear with me a little bit and we'll talk about the consequences of that. But this trend continued. Social spending increased. Defense spending, well, that couldn't keep up now that Britain was spending more and more on things like NHS, on welfare. And for many, the official date of the end of the British Empire comes in January 1968. January 1968, the British Prime Minister Harold Wilson announced that the UK would permanently withdraw its troops east of Suez. So all of Britain's military bases in the Middle East and Southeast Asia and that whole part of the world, they would be abandoned. Why? Well, money, again, was the key reason here. Wilson's government put a £2 billion cap on defence spending, and that's in their terms, but over the rest of the decade. And so to meet that cap, well, they had to cut all kinds of defense commitments. They had to find all kinds of ways to cut defense spending. And so the decision was, well, we'll just withdraw from half the world. Everything east of Suez, we're gone. And the United States was incredulous at the time. U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, he said he could not believe that free aspirin and false teeth were more important than Britain's role in the world. That's how the British Empire fell. It fell because a government, and not just a government, because a people decided that free aspirin and false teeth were more important to them than their role in the world. That was the popular thing to do. And I think if you were to conduct polls, I think the vast majority today would say that was the right decision. That yes, free aspirin and false teeth are worth more than our role in the world. And the point I want to make really is look at the focus. Look at where Britain's priorities were. Now, I understand the desire for a health service. Now, if you're not looking to God for help, and if all of your trust is in man and the solutions man can offer, the idea that you could have a loved one get sick and that there could be a cure easily available, but you can't afford it, that's a pretty terrifying thought. Now, that didn't happen as much as people might believe prior to the NHS, but I get the appeal of that and for that kind of thing of social spending. But look at the main thing I want to focus on is look at the change in focus. Everything turned inwards. At the start of the British Empire, there was an outward focus. It was driven by a belief that Britain could and should make the world a better place, that it had a duty to do that. We talked about slavery in the last time I was on this show and Britain's history with slavery and stamping out slavery. And that push right at the start of the 19th century to get rid of slavery, well, that is what gave Victorian-era imperialism its start. That was its starting impetus to go out and end slavery. I've got another book down under here. This is Jan Morris's Heaven's Command. But this author writes here, so the first monuments of Queen Victoria's empire were monuments of liberty. The fight against slavery at its source would continue throughout the Victorian era, being a prime motive, as we shall see, of the great mid-century explorations, and it proved a fertile seed of imperial emotions. He quotes Lord John Russell in the House of Commons in 1950, and he's talking at the time that Britain is stamping out slavery in Brazil, the world's largest focus for the slave trade, the world's largest destination for slaves. He writes, "It appears to me that if we give up this high and holy work, of getting rid of slavery. We have no right to expect a continuance of those blessings which, by God's favor, we have so long enjoyed. So if we stop trying to go out into the world and getting rid of some of these evils like slavery, well, we've got no right to expect continued blessings. If we want to be blessed, we need to be giving. We need to be doing good things for other people. Jan Morris writes, the adventures that were to come as imperialism itself developed into a kind of faith and dominion became a national ambition for its own sake, were grounded upon this good old base, erected so long before by the earnest philanthropists of Clapham and Exeter Hall. And when evangelism had long since lost its dynamism, when a harsher generation was in command, impelled by cruder ends, still the memory of these aspirations tempered the brashness of the British Empire and sometimes touched the imperial conscience. This was at the beginning of Britain's empire. And it was a push to go out and in a lot of ways make the world a better place. And it did a lot of that. Kishore Mahambuni, he is the author of Has the West Lost It? And as you can tell, that's not a typical English name. He wrote, if the West had not succeeded, we would not have succeeded. We would still be in extreme poverty. Historian and Harvard professor, I think he's still at Harvard. You wonder how long he'll stay there. Niall Ferguson, in his book Empire. He wrote, the fact remains that no organization in history has done more to promote the free movement of goods, capital, and labor than the British Empire in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And no organization has done more to impose Western norms of law, order, and governance around the world. And in that book, he talks about the good that Britain did for the world. That the British Empire led to goods, to wealth, people, most importantly, ideas, flowing out from Britain to other parts of the world, that it brought good governance. Now, I've seen some in the left recently claim that Britain impoverished nations, and I saw one academic point to Zambia, whose economy is 28 times smaller than the UK's. And they said, well, look at that. Look at Zambia. Their economy is 28 times smaller than the UK's. That's Britain's fault. Britain made that empire or that country smaller and took all its wealth. What that academic was leaving out is you go back to 1955 and the UK's economy was only 7 times bigger than Zambia. So Zambia's economy becoming so much tinier than Britain's, that's all happened after Zambia became independent. When Britain was there, actually it had come a long way and it was only 7 times smaller. That's still significantly smaller, but nowhere near 28 times smaller. And so a lot of people, definitely not everyone, but a lot of people involved in the imperial project were outwards looking. They believed that they could and should make the world a better place. They believed they could and should profit while doing that, sure. But they believed that they were working as a force for good. Now, was that always done perfectly? No. Were there some very selfish individuals involved in that pursuit? Yes. Were there abuses of that? Yes. Was there a lot of self-righteousness involved in that? Absolutely. But there was an outward focus. And then things started to turn around. And you saw this even towards the end of the Victorian era, where things started to become a bit more selfish. And even that quote I read makes some allusions to that. You saw it after World War I, where Britain as a whole decided, well, we don't want to fight for a better world. It's just not worth it. And then you saw it after World War II, when Britain just gave up the empire. And you see it in some history that people don't want to talk about much. Like I said, Britain just completely lost interest in India, happy just to get rid of it, happy to be done with it, wasn't even controversial. Everyone just wanted to let it go and forget about it. And what was the result? And like I said, this history doesn't get talked about much because it doesn't really suit anyone's agenda. Those that hate empire don't want to talk about the catastrophe that followed when the empire withdrew. It doesn't make Britain look very good either. So it's not a pleasant history really for anyone to dwell on. But about 1 million people, well, there's estimates all over the place, anywhere from I think around 500,000 to 2 million, but about 1 million people died in Britain's withdrawal from India. A massive figure, 5 to 6 million people forced to leave their homes. You're talking about an absolute catastrophe. Andrew Roberts wrote, "This represents one of the most shameful moments in the history of the English-speaking peoples in the 20th century." And Britain didn't really care. It wasn't this massive scandal back at home in England. And as you saw, there wasn't really even much debate about leaving India. There was no, you know, if you talk about that inward focus, there wasn't really anyone even saying, well, okay, we're convinced we're going to give India back to the Indians, but for their own benefit, let's make sure that we manage this carefully and that we do this properly and we think it through. Now, this massive inward focus meant nobody really cared about that even. It was just a case of, well, let's just get rid of these drains on our resources so that we can, you know, focus on our social spending. At the time, Lord Mountbatten, who was in charge of it, he said only 100,000 people died. And that was, you know, he was massaging those figures even to get it down to 100,000. But only 100,000? Oh, that's okay if it means getting rid of India so that we can, you know, keep focusing on our NHS and on our welfare. And people were just content with that. Well, that's okay, only 100,000 people died. And that if we're talking about the shameful history of Britain, the shameful history of the British Empire, that's some shameful history. Just to walk away. And yeah, okay, well, 1 million people died. You know, no big deal. Like I said, there are parallels for today where you get a minority of agitators convince law and order that they're not wanted, convince the forces that are holding the peace that, well, no, we don't want you here, defund the police or the British Empire needs to withdraw. And so they go out and then you have some kind of massive catastrophe like that. That's because Britain was focused inwards. There was no grand vision, a failure of vision, as Paul Johnson wrote. There was no vision and people literally perished. That's the story of the fall of the British Empire. Well, we'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about this change in focus and a practical, very hopeful lesson that we can learn from it. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity and our ancestry. Request the United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free one-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We've been talking about the end of the British Empire, about this change in focus, about how Britain chose the NHS, the National Health Service, and welfare over empire, and how the nation focused inwards. And what a catastrophe it was. I mean, we looked at India, but that same catastrophe played out again and again and again in country after country after country. You know, you had people like Robert Mugabe come to power, a terrorist. And were quite happy to hand over power to those individuals because Britain had no grand vision anymore and were just focused inwards. Like I said, there's a critical, practical lesson to learn from all this. And I'd like to point you all to the Trumpet brief yesterday from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. That was called The Glory of Empire, I believe. But If you're not a subscriber to our Trumpet Brief, that's something I'd really encourage you to sign up for. You can do that on our website, thetrumpet.com. And there are daily emails that we send out that have a message from one of the writers. Typically, we have something from Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry about once a week or so. It's been working out at least over the last few weeks. And you know, Mr. Stephen Flurry will have the Trumpet Brief, or from Mr. Hilliker, Mr. McDonald. And they're also a great tool just to keep up to date with what we've got on our website. There's a lot, even if you are a Trumpet Brief subscriber, that you can do to kind of customize what you get in that email, and we can send you a list of all the articles that we've published over the last 24 hours, all the new radio shows that have come out. It's a great way to keep in touch with what we're doing. But you know, Mr. Flurry is writing on this very much on the subject of empire in that Trumpet Brief. And he was focusing on Winston Churchill, whose statue we've seen come under attack, and Winston Churchill's view of empire. So I've been talking about how Britain just turned its back on empire. There was one person, really, only one really of any significance, who really spoke out against it, who opposed this turning away from empire and had a different vision for empire, and that was Winston Churchill. He really loved that empire, and that's something even some of the pro-Churchill, his supporters, are a bit ashamed of today. But Mr. Flurry, in that Trumpet Brief, he writes, "The truth is that Churchill's love for empire was actually one of his greatest characteristics. It was this love that enabled him to resist Hitler. The love for empire contains a noble lesson that, if we learn, would enable us to solve the massive problems facing our nations today." So there's some important things that we can learn from this. And Mr. Flurry quotes from a pretty huge range of biographers in that article as he goes into Churchill's love for empire. He quotes his doctor, Dr. Moran, who said, "If Winston has believed in anything at all in the long course of his life, it has been in the British Empire and all that it stands for." Mr. Flurry writes, "It's easy to oversimplify Winston Churchill's love of the empire. He didn't love it simply because it was English or powerful or wealthy or because it ruled over tens of millions of people. Churchill's writings show that his love for empire went much, much deeper. There was a selfless, altruistic, noble dimension to his devotion. Winston Churchill wanted to share the British Empire with the rest of mankind. Churchill believed the British Empire had a larger purpose." He quotes Emeret. I didn't write down. I think it's Kirk Emeret, I think is the name of the author, who wrote that Churchill saw the British Empire acted to lift human life away from barbarism and savagery towards civilization and human excellence. And Mr. Flurry talks about how there have been a lot of evil empires in world history, a lot of empires that have done very evil things, that have made the world more barbaric, more violent, and we're going to see more of that in the times ahead. But he writes, "The ugly history has contributed to the evil view that many people today have of empire in general, especially among intellectuals and scholars in the West. However, the existence of these barbarizing empires does not change the good that a civilizing empire can do. And the scholar's cynical portrayal of the British Empire is very deceptive and dishonest." It is interesting that the British Empire is about the only empire you hear anything bad about. I mean, I mentioned Constantine, but really you don't see anybody talking about the legacy of the Roman Empire, certainly not the Holy Roman Empire. You don't see anybody talking about the flaws of Napoleon. Even the USSR, you see these same people that smash statues of Jefferson and Washington love their statues of Lenin and Marx and will wear T-shirts with Che Guevara. But Mr. Flurry writes, "At its core, is it immoral to have an empire? No, there isn't anything wrong with an empire if it brings good. Truly, the right kind of imperialism can accomplish great things." He includes a quote from James Anthony Throudray, which I think is just fascinating, and it's in his book Oceana. He writes, "A man who is more than himself, who is part of an institution, who has devoted himself to a cause, or is a citizen of an imperial power, expands to the scope and fullness of the larger organism, and the grander the organization, the larger and more important the unit that knows he belongs to it. His thoughts are wider, his interests less selfish, his ambitions ampler and nobler. A great nation makes great men. A small nation makes little men." I think that's a fascinating point. It's one of the really fascinating things from world history. And you can look all throughout history and see these countries that have had, say, an imperial phase, and how many great cultural and scientific figures they've produced during this imperial phase. And you think, well, what's that got to do even with an empire? How does conquering a lot of territory mean that you're going to have great authors or scientists? It's not a very simple kind of 1+1=2 causal relationship there. But there's something very powerful about empire. And you see, you know, even with evil empires, you know, things, take the USSR, you know, one of the biggest forces for evil in the 20th century. I am not justifying anything the USSR has done by in any degree. You know, responsible for more deaths than any other empire in history, except perhaps Mao's China. But look at Russia's cultural output during the Soviet Union. You know, the great composers that it produced. You had Prokofiev and Shostakovich. I'll count Shostakovich as a great composer. There are some things he did that I like. I guess even in film, you had people like Sergei Eisenstein. But you had this massive cultural output. You see it 100 years before with the Russian Empire as well, and the kind of the grand imperial phase of Russia. And you have people like Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, you know, getting a bit later in there. You've got Prokofiev, you've got Tolstoy and some of these great Russian novelists, and Pushkin, and this massive cultural outpouring. And then you look at Russia today, and where's that gone? I mean, fine, some of these individuals came from countries that are now independent, I guess, like Georgia or Ukraine and things like that, but you don't. You take all of the former Soviet Union, and where are its real, you know, great scientists, composers, novelists, artists? They're not there. Ancient Greece is another fascinating example. You had famous Greek thinkers coming when Greece was a collection of small city-states, you know, men like Socrates and Plato. But a lot of Greece's greatest, most famous thinkers, they came after Alexander the Great, spread the Greco-Macedonian Empire over the whole of the known world. And again, I'm not defending Alexander the Great and the Greco-Macedonian Empire. But I'm making the point that you have this empire vision go hand in hand with some of these massive achievements and great men. You know, the Greeks pretty much pushed science as far as it could go with the technology that they had available at the time. You know, you had Greek thinkers talking about the Earth orbiting the sun. But they didn't have the technology to refine glass to the point that you can make a telescope and point it at the sky to really prove that idea. But you had men like Euclid and Archimedes, and then you have all the philosophers that are so famous. But then where do you really hear much about Greek scientists now? Or authors, or rhetoricians. I mean, hopefully there aren't any famous ones I'm missing, but it's hard to think of any. So you can see how this empire, there's a vision there that can help bring the most out of people, just even bring the most out of the human spirit. Having this grander vision than self. A great nation makes great men. A small nation makes little men. That was that quote from James Anthony Frudra. His thoughts are wise, his interests less selfish, his ambitions ampler and nobler. Now, in a sense, we need empire. We need this grander vision of what we can do for mankind, an outward vision. Mr. Fleury, in that article, he wrote, "In fact, if you understand the gospel that Jesus Christ brought to this earth, advanced news from God the Father of the soon coming kingdom of God, it was at its heart an imperialistic message. The kingdom of God could very accurately be called the God family empire." Now, imperialism is demonized today. It's a bad thing. But that's not the way that God looks at it. And in the British Empire, you see this importance of looking outwards. It rose when people had a global vision of what they could do for the world. And maybe not everybody, but at least a significant movement. And even that, yes, it was still on a carnal level, was still based in selfish human nature, but they at least had some kind of vision of what they could do for the world. And it fell when people got into being selfish, and well, who cares, and we're just going to look at our welfare state. Mr. Fleury touched on this in a recent Key of David about Shakespeare. He's what he said in that Key of David, clip 2.
Shakespeare wrote all of his plays in poetry. Miriam Joseph notes that Shakespeare lived in an age ardently devoted to the reading of the Bible, and wherein a knowledge of the figures of rhetoric, quote, helped much for the better understanding of the Holy Scriptures. That's from Shakespeare's use of the arts of language. He wrote at a time when the British people were ardently devoted to the reading of the Bible, but that's not the case today, and the empire is gone. Is there a connection? Well, of course there is. Of course there is. See, again, if you want to rule an empire, if you want to really be an empire builder, you better learn this lesson or your empire will never, ever last. It will always falter.
Is there a connection? Is there a connection between people believing the Bible and the British Empire? Absolutely. And it was pushed forwards by men that believed the Bible, that read the Bible, that did not understand it completely, that did not have God's Holy Spirit, but still saw principles in there that they worked to uphold and bring to the world. And it fell as people stopped doing that, stopped reading the Bible, and started looking inwards. And if we want to unlock our potential, well, we've got to be looking outwards, looking at giving. And this is where this can become very practical. For us, even individually, we've got to have a global vision for our lives, for our Bible study. It's not enough just to be getting information and knowledge for ourselves and just listening. We can't be like the British Empire. Well, we've got all of these resources. We've got a bit of wealth. Let's spend it now on us. And, you know, let's not think about reaching new people and expanding on what we can give with this. Let's instead think about the NHS and social spending. No, we need an outward vision, a vision of what we can give. Here's just a great quote from Mr. Armstrong. This is at the end of a radio broadcast that he gave. Why were you born? This is clip 3.
My friends, I have noticed that those who have their hearts in the work of God remain Christians. And they grow spiritually. And they do manage to overcome. And those who neglect it and just have their minds on themselves, of course, you must overcome, you must grow spiritually. But if you try to do that alone, without this collective, this cooperative work of God, I've never known anyone yet that could do that and succeed.
So if you're just focused on yourself, you're not going to be overcoming your problems. But if you have this global vision, you know, you'll be like Britain, focusing on the NHS, and it's just this decline, and you got to the point that we can't even afford our NHS today, and even that's going to implode. But if you want to be overcoming your problems, well, we need to be focused outwards, an outward vision, focusing on giving. And Mr. Armstrong talked about this in his book, Mystery of the Ages. He talked about, well, this is part of why, as Christians, we need God's church. Why we can't just be out by ourselves getting God's word, but just, you know, not doing anything with it. He talked about how God is training a group of people to give to the whole world, that he's working with people now. And the church is the way that God has put in place to train us and teach us. And that if God's going to use us as a part of a team to give to the world, well, we need to be training with that team now to serve together. And he talked about, well, you know, how does God train us? By getting us to focus on ourselves and self-improvement? No, by giving us an outgoing mission, a serving mission, a giving mission. He writes in Mystery of the Ages that by feeding the sheep, developing them in God's spiritual character, this is what God has given us to develop our spiritual character. God has given them their part in supporting, backing up the Great Commission. Go ye into all the world. Supporting God's work, giving to the world, being part of God's empire, God's family empire in the form of his church now, well, that's how we become great. That's how we maximize our potential. That's how we get more of God's spirit flowing in our lives, something that no one in relation to the British Empire had anything to do with. And you can see this outward focus throughout the Bible. I'll just turn to one scripture in closing in Daniel chapter 12. I don't think I've got time to do some of the other ones I have in my notes. Well, we'll see, but probably not. We'll just look at one scripture at the end in Daniel chapter 12. And verse 3, it says, "And they that shall be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." So how do we receive this brilliant reward? To shine as the stars forever? Well, it's about turning many people to righteousness. Not just focusing inwards and just trying to just maybe just be righteous ourselves, but by looking outwards, supporting the God family empire, not just doing that on our own, but part of the organization that God has set up to do it. But that's how we do it. We get our hearts in the work. We look outwards. And that's how we turn people to righteousness. Or that's how we become, shine as the stars forever and ever. So there's a lot of negative as you look at the history of the end of the British Empire. But when you see, you know, when you look at it this way and you see the importance of how God wants us just to give outwards forever, there is a wonderful vision there. So that's about all that we have time for. You can read more about this in Mr. Armstrong's free book, Mystery of the Ages. We're very glad to send all of our material to you free of charge. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can email the show. You can get in touch with us at td@kpcg. We'd love to hear from you. And I believe, Mr. Flurry, all being well, we'll be back with you out on the road tomorrow.